Well, last night it was two chapters and five characteristics of God, but that, I'm afraid, was just warming up for tonight. It's eight chapters and ten plagues tonight. We could be here all the way through till breakfast, and the good side about that, I'll tell you, is if we're here at breakfast time, we can probably pick up the packed lunch for the afternoon tea if you're under five and you've financed the situation. Now look, popular opinion may have thought that it would all be over swiftly, but the experts actually did not suggest that the war would necessarily be a quick one. If you listen carefully, the experts was convinced that the tyrant, with an appalling history of human rights abuse, would never back down. Though in fact he would grudgingly give little concessions just to eke out the whole affair. All the same, there was only going to be one winner. We heard the expert last night. "I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand compels him. So I will stretch out my hand and strike the Egyptian with all the wonders that I'll perform among them, and after that he will let you go." God, of course, is an expert who is always right. And over the next eight chapters, Egypt's hit with a sequence of plagues as her Pharaoh resists Moses' demand that he should let God's people go. And God makes his point very dramatically as the river turns to blood, and then the country finds herself invaded by frogs, gnats, flies, cattle die, there's an outbreak of boils, a deadly hailstorm, darkness, and it's all topped off by the death of the firstborn. And they are great stories for kids, aren't they? I mean, you can imagine Trevor and Talia. Well, they hardly need to let their imagination go on that one. It's easy to work out some fun drama or, if you want to calm them down, all kinds of things you could colour in. Boils and frogs. And you say, "Hugh, look, we are adults here, please. We've grown out of colouring in. We left that behind when we finished our geography degree." Have you got anything to say to me as I battle to hang on to or work out faith in the real world of the 21st century? Well, bear with me, will you, for a few more minutes. Come with me to one of those pre-fight press conferences, you know, where the boxers or their managers square up to each other, and if it's a really big fight, then Don King, he of the sticking up hair, would be there, but somehow he missed out on this one. Because it is something of the big fight. And that's where I want to begin as we come to Exodus chapter 5. Here is the warm-up for the big fight. Exodus chapter 5, verse 1, "Afterwards Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, 'This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says, let my people go.'" That's called putting your cards on the table, laying down the challenge, and Pharaoh is happy to rise to it. After all, these are his slaves, and they underpin his economy. So Pharaoh said, verse 2, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go?" Now, please look at these questions. We're going to look at the beginning and the end of these plagues tonight. Don't worry, we're not going through every chapter in detail. But this is the key to everything that follows. What kind of God does he think he is? Because one thing's for sure, he is not the God of the majority religion in Egypt. Nor is he the God whom millions elsewhere in the world follow. "So why should I listen to him?" Pharaoh's saying. "I don't know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go." Please, we must understand that this big fight that happens through these coming chapters is all to do with a fight for identity. The fight is all about establishing who this God is. He is not some insignificant deity looked to by just a few thousand nobodies. And if I've got that clear, I'll understand that the battle is not between Moses and Pharaoh. Actually, it's not even between God and Pharaoh. It's bigger than that. Look in the blue corner. In the blue corner, well, you have the one spoken of in verse 1, the Lord. I am who I am. I will be what I will be. Well, it's time to show himself now, the God of Israel, which doesn't actually sound much, seeing as Israel are an oppressed slave people. And with him are his spokesmen, Moses and Aaron. A couple of 80-year-olds demanding freedom for their people, which is hardly a frightening thought for a dictator. And in the red corner, the gods of Egypt. With all Pharaoh's might and his magicians' power. And please don't think of his magicians as doing conjuring tricks. Magic was big in Egypt at the time. It was a way of tapping into forces behind our world. And so were the nature gods. And each plague can actually be related to one particular god of Egypt or another. From the Nile, turned to blood in the first plague, to the sun, blacked out as the land is plunged into darkness in the ninth plague. See, this isn't just a battle with an individual despot. It is with a whole culture. I think we could understand that's what's going on in these chapters. The whole culture, the whole way of living, the whole way of thinking of the Egyptian people is being put to the test and undermined. I wonder if we sometimes understand the battle that really the living God fights with the gods of our culture. The gods of materialism, they've got a firm grip on many of us. You know, those who bring their lucky numbers as an offering to the shrine of the lottery each week. I know, I mean, I laugh at it, but look, I live in a thoroughly respectable, middle-class, safe, well-off area. We have, well, it's just closed briefly, but we have just down the road from us a little SO garage with a lottery point. And just a few months ago, before they closed, I was chatting with the shop assistant there, and she told me that every week one man comes in and spends £80 on the lottery. Can you imagine? £80 a week. And both of us sat there thinking what we do with £80 a week. Of course, it's easy to do the lottery one, isn't it? But which of us has not been tempted by the enticing offers of the different gods of plastic? Who sell their shrines to me every week? Seducing me into spending what I haven't got on pleasures that never quite satisfy, but which leave me enslaved to them, or at least to the plastic. Or maybe it's just the gods of superstition, which actually still loom large for many. You know, down at the basic levels of Lady Luck and the broken mirror and number 13 and walking under the ladder, but up to the magic powers of the forces beyond, which have a powerful attraction for others, the stars of astrology, the spiritual forces of the occult. Now, don't sniff as if we're now in a high-tech world. When I was last in Blackpool, I saw on one of the things there, the offer was, your horoscope by computer. And each plague exposes the impotence of Egypt's gods. Their powerlessness to defend their people from attack, their inability to deliver. See, when your gods are stripped of credibility, but what do? If the housing market and the stock market were both to crash, yeah, then where's your security and your hope for the future? If we discover the spiritual forces we rely on can't deliver, just down the road from us, it's a village, it's just a tack-on suburb to Sheffield. There's a little place there, and a mother of two adult sons died recently. And 6 months later, one son, a spiritualist, said to his brother, Do you know, BT have given her phone number to someone else. His brother said to him, well, yeah, I mean, they do that in the end, actually. You find, you know, they wait a few months and then they will hand it on to someone else. And then suddenly his brother clicked and he said, anyway, how do you know they've done that? Oh, said the spiritualist son, he said, I've rung her every day to see if she'll answer. 6 months dead. He's rung her every day. When your gods are stripped of credibility, what do? In that case, despair. In Pharaoh's case, harden your hearts. I mean, it's... Remember back in that recession, the early 90s, which really hit the southeast and the city, and I remember being rung up. It was a time when the media suddenly kind of got onto us, and I was rung up by an American radio station who wanted to do an interview with me because they heard we had lots of people coming. I said, yeah, it's true, lots of people are coming to church. And it's true, is it, that lots of people have started coming to the church since the recession? No, that's not. I said, it's been full for years. I said, I'm going to put a few more chairs out some Tuesdays. I mean, this was just before the bomb hit and everything was going. The story I want is the story of people who've come to church since the recession. I said, look, I can give you a story of a full church, I said, but I can't. Oh, and he's not interested. Actually, I think Doug will agree, it didn't make people rush to hear the gospel. It just put their heads harder down in the failing economy. As Pharaoh finds the rugs being pulled from under his feet, his heart gets harder. Oh yes, when God speaks of what will happen, he talks of hardening Pharaoh's heart. It is not out of God's control. But that never removes responsibility from Pharaoh. After all the early plagues, we hear of Pharaoh hardening his heart, turning his back on the clear evidence of God facing him. Even when he finds half his cabinet divided and saying, let them go, they're just ruining the place. He won't. He makes his concessions. You know, well, why don't you sacrifice in Egypt? Or go, but not too far. Or just the men. Or leave the cattle behind. And then he puts his veto down again. When your heart's hardened, you keep on acting against your own interests as well as against God's. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says, let my people go so that they may hold a festival to me in the desert. Or if you turn to verse 3, Pharaoh says, who is this Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? Then they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Now let's take a 3-day journey into the desert to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God, or he may strike us with plagues or with the sword. This 3-day business doesn't seem to be a particularly precise distance. I don't know whether it was just a kind of understood way of haggling in the day, but it seems to be saying far enough away to be out of the grip of the Egyptians. And God's going to make this happen. Actually, when you get through the plagues, it is no wonder that Exodus becomes the great reminder to Israel of her God, recalled again and again in the Old Testament. Let my people go. Who is this Lord that I should obey him? Well, the God with power stronger than all our cultural gods. The God will use that power for his people and against those forces which enslave his people. But of course, we've gone past the reminders of the Exodus in that way, past great songs like that psalm that Neil read to us, and we Christians look back on a greater Exodus still. The cross, where God struck in judgment and took the punishment we deserve in Jesus. The cross, where Jesus' death became God's great miracle blow for freedom. The cross, where we can know rescue not from a human slavery, but sin slavery. And the big fight ends with the big punch. And that's what I want you to turn through as we go through. I'm afraid you'll have to do the colouring in your own time, and come to chapter 11. Because in the in-between chapters, Pharaoh and the gods of Egypt have been outgunned at every turn, but stubbornly refused to surrender, and certainly won't let Moses and the people go. But there is one more punch in God's armoury. So verse 1 of chapter 11, the Lord said to Moses, I will bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt, and after that he will let you go from here. And when he does, he'll drive you out completely. Actually, the punch is a very frightening one. He describes it in verse 4. Moses said, this is what the Lord says, about midnight I'll go throughout Egypt, and every firstborn son in Egypt will die. I'm a second child, and I wince as I read this. From the firstborn son of Pharaoh, Ramses III had a very long reign, and Memeta, who succeeded him, was not his eldest son. The evidence isn't conclusive, but maybe Memeta's elder brother died that night. From the firstborn son of Pharaoh, who sits on the throne, to the firstborn son of the slave girl, who is at her handmill, and all the firstborn of the cattle as well. There'll be loud wailing throughout Egypt, worse than there's ever been or ever will be again. But among the Israelites, not a dog will bark at any man or animal. Then you'll know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. And all these officials of yours will come to me, bowing down before me and saying, go, you and all the people who follow you, and after that I will leave. The Passover is the big punch. It'll have a significance that's going to shape the culture of a people. And if you were to read on in these chapters, you will discover astonishing confidence on God's part. What's being said here, you see, is while everyone is still in Egypt, before it's happened, read chapter 12 and verse 1, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, this month is to be for you the first month of your year. It's going to change their calendar. It's that significant. It's going to mark the beginning of their year because it's going to mark the beginning of Israel's life as a nation under God. Verse 3, tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man's to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. See, at the heart of the Passover is a family meal. It's a very domestic affair. There's no temple, no altar, no priest. The head of the family presumably acts as its priest, makes sure they've got a lamb, there's enough for everyone to eat, and above all, that the blood is put around the door of the home. Verse 7, then they're to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and the top of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs. That's vital. Because when you get to verse 12, you discover that God is going to pass through. On that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn, both men and animals, and I'll bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. And if you're there, and they were, and there's not time to get out, your only hope is that as he passes through, he passes over. That's how it gets its name. Verse 13. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. And it's just what happened. You get to verse 29 of chapter 12. At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh sat on the throne, to the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeon, and the firstborn of all the livestock as well. Pharaoh and all his officials and all the Egyptians got up during the night, and there was loud wailing in Egypt, for there wasn't a house without someone dead. And that was true for the people of Israel too. There wasn't a house without someone dead. Because in the houses of Israel, there was a dead lamb instead of a dead firstborn. The blood of the lamb was offered in place of the blood of the firstborn. When thousands of years later, the Apostle Paul can write to a group of very young Christians, and as he brings them back to the heart of their faith, he can say this: Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Do the pennies begin to drop? Do we begin to see what he's saying? He's meant to take me back to the morning after, the dreadful night before, when everyone would go round the houses and check the beds, see who's at the breakfast table. I suspect even the noisy dining room would be quiet that morning. The truth sinks in. Sin punished. Death happened. But in our household, a substitute died instead. Passed over in judgment and released from slavery, all in the same breath. Look at verse 31 of chapter 12. During the night, Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, "Up, leave my people, you and the Israelites. Go, worship the Lord as you've requested. Up, leave, go, just get out of here." So you get to the end of the chapter, verse 51. All the Israelites did just what the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, and on that very day the Lord brought the Israelites out of Egypt by their divisions. Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. See, Pharaohs and Egyptians are not exactly our big problems as Christians today. I don't know about your neighbours, but they're not the big deal for us, are they? The forces of sin and evil are far greater and very real. Jesus, the Christ, has been a Passover lamb for us. His death, his sacrifice, has been like that lamb's death and sacrifice. Sin punished, death happened, but for us a substitute's died. Him, not us. The Christian passed over in judgment and released from the tyranny of sin. It's no longer our master in the same way as before. Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. You know, to say that is to speak with huge confidence. I've forgotten where I got this illustration from. I sincerely hope it wasn't David Jackman. There's nothing worse than sitting there while someone tells your illustration badly, isn't it? But, imagine that the first Passover, just before the Exodus, you know, and Mr. Smith and Mr. Jones, two Hebrews with remarkable names, are discussing the extraordinary events of the previous weeks and months, and Mr. Smith says to Mr. Jones, "Have you sprinkled the blood of a lamb on the two doorposts and on the lintel over the entrance to your house?" "Of course," replies Mr. Jones. "I followed Moses' instructions exactly." "Oh, so have I," says Mr. Smith. "I've got to admit I'm pretty nervous, though. I mean, my boy Charlie means the world to me. If, as Moses says, the angel of death's passing through the land tonight and taking out all the firstborn in the land, I don't know what I'd do if Charlie died." "But that's just the point," said Mr. Jones. "He won't die. That's why you sprinkled the blood on the doorposts and the lintel. Moses says when the angel of death sees the blood, he'll pass over. The house is protected. Charlie will be safe. What are you worried about?" "Well, I know, says Mr. Smith rather irritably, "but you've got to admit there have been some very strange goings on recently. I know some of those plagues only hit the Egyptians, but some of them have hit us too. And the thought that Charlie could be in danger, I mean, it is very worrying." Mr. Jones is not too sympathetic. And he just says, "Well, I really can't imagine why you're fretting and what you're all so uptight about. After all, I've got a son too, and I think I love him just as much as you love your Charlie. And I'm completely at peace. God's promise, the angel of death will pass over every house whose door is marked by blood in the way he said, and I take him at his word. And that night, the angel of death passed through the land. Who lost his son? Mr. Smith or Mr. Jones? The answer, of course, is neither. The fulfillment of God's promise that the angel of death would pass over and not destroy the firstborn didn't depend on the intensity of the faith of the people in the homes. It just depended on whether they put the blood on the doorposts and on the lintel. It's just the same with those of us who've trusted Christ and his cross work on our behalf. The promise of rescue, the assurance that we're accepted by Almighty God, is not tied to the intensity of our faith. Actually, you might have Mr. Smith's uncertainty. What I'm trying to tell you is you don't need to have it. Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. The big punch has been landed. The fight's over. Last point. The big fight, the big punch. Yeah, because when you read chapter 12, it doesn't end with the Passover event. It goes on to the Passover meal, doesn't it? And I've refrained from calling it the Big Mac. The big reminder. The big reminder. This meal, you see, that they ate was not a one-off. The rescue was unique, of course, but with a confidence that would be labelled arrogance in anyone else, God plans the celebration before the victory. It's there in verse 14 of chapter 12. Nothing's happened yet, remember? And yet he says, this is a day you are to commemorate. For the generations to come, you shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance. Now, notice the importance of this festival. You see, you come to verse 24, obey these instructions. You know, one of the things you know at the beginning is that Moses is nothing if he's not a details man. Obey these instructions as a lasting ordinance for you and your descendants when you enter the land that the Lord will give you as he promised. I don't think even Moses knew he was 40 years away from that yet. Observe this ceremony. And when your children ask you, what does this ceremony mean to you? Then tell them it's the Passover sacrifice to the Lord who passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt and spared our homes when he struck down the Egyptians. Remember, all of this is before they've even eaten the first meal. The big reminder, which is to be there for generation after generation to come, of their God. I mean, you can imagine it, can't you, what would happen as the years went by. It was a big occasion and, you know, great family meal, and we're all going to be there, like it or not, and you'll wear your best clothes, and so you've got to just try and look smart, and that doesn't count, Neil. Got to be smarter than that. And, you know, if you're one of the little ones, you don't have much choice on what's smart. You get what, well, probably what Mum and Dad thought was smart when they were under five. It's going to be more than a packed lunch. But, you know, you get one of those flowery pink smocks or the velvet jacket and knickerbockers or whatever they had. But there you are, and best behaviour. And when, you know, as everyone's waiting for the meal to start, the children do what they always do and start whining. Now, Mum, do we have to? It's boring. What's it all about anyway? Dad, why do we do it like this? Why can't we just get on with it and enjoy the meal? Parents are not to be thinking. Parents are not to be thinking. Little children should be seen and not heard. Parents are not to be saying, don't talk like that, Johnny. It's very special, and Granny would be shocked to hear you saying things like that. No, parents are to be saying, look, this family meal, it's a serious reminder of our God and just how real his judgment and his mercy are. Way back when we were in Egypt, he struck down the Egyptians but passed over our house to spare us. And I guess in the early years there was many a home when they would have said, your father and grandfather would not be alive today if it wasn't for Passover. Well, thousands of years later, they were still celebrating it. Leave Exodus behind, will you, and turn on to Luke's Gospel and chapter 22. And Jesus is heading for the cross. And here's some of the reasons why Paul makes the link when he writes, Christ our Passover lamb has been sacrificed, because the gospel writers keep making the link. Look at verse 7 of chapter 22. Then came the day of unleavened bread on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. And Jesus sent Peter and John saying, go and make preparations for us to eat the Passover. Where do you want us to prepare it? They asked, and he replied, as you enter the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him to the house that he enters, and say to the owner of the house, the teacher asks, where is the guest room when I may eat the Passover with my disciples? And he'll show you a large upper room all furnished, and make preparations there. And they left and found things just as Jesus had told them. So they prepared the Passover. Yeah, you don't have to be the brightest, do you? You can afford to be more than a little on the slow side and still get it. This has something to do with the Passover. But it turns out to be a Passover with a difference. Because just when the action starts we think we know where it's going, suddenly you get to verse 19. And Jesus took bread and gave thanks and broke it and gave it to them saying, this is my body given for you. And then in verse 20, in the same way after supper he took the cup saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood which is poured out for you. And as Jesus applies the Passover, he looks to a different sacrifice. Not the lambs at the meal back in Egypt, but his. Not to Egypt, but to Calvary and to his cross. And you say, look, if you want a festival meal, surely lamb's a better deal than bread. Well, it might be, but it's missing the point. There's many a Jew who still celebrates today the Passover as a lasting reminder of that great rescue. But a Christian celebrates the Lord's Supper as a lasting reminder of an even greater rescue. The Passover points to a God who saved his people even as his judgment struck down Egyptians. The blood of the Lamb spared his people. But the Lord's Supper points to a God who saved his people even as his judgment struck down his Christ. Jesus was the lamb struck for us. Sin and death are our enemies. Someone said, look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. And Passover time, he lived that out. He took bread and said, do this in remembrance of me. Every time we're at the Lord's Supper, we're saying, Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Now, however frequently you do it, I know we've probably all done it time and again, and you know, I think we sometimes forget the power of ritual. In our circles, we're used to talking about the powerlessness of ritual and repetition. You know, we turn our noses up and speak of spiritual dryness. And ritual and liturgy can be dead. all too easily, but only when their significance and power are forgotten. I think our culture understands the power of ritual better than we do. Why do you think advertisers repeat? Not just to keep their product's name in our minds for the next time we pass the right supermarket shelf. But as they repeat their adverts with their stories, they're creating a world, aren't they, in which their product holds an important central place. You know the Guinness advert? With that key moment in the hurling game? You really don't need to understand anything about hurling. Any red-blooded sporting male understands it. You know, it's the decisive moment in the match. The fears, the tensions, the hopes, the camaraderie, the triumph, the sweaty palms. And what makes the difference? Guinness. Only believe. Well, if it doesn't sound irreverent, there is something of that in the Lord's Supper. Passover is once a year. Lord's Supper is, for most of us, is more frequent, though in its early days there was certainly no fancy silver or a trace of a clergyman, just a family meal with a head of a household, but it's something we participate in. We're there, not just physically, but theologically. It puts me into the real world as God sees it and connects me to the Christ who's central to it. I might come guilty and hesitant. I might come saying, I mean, rarely out loud, but in my mind, you know, if you knew me, I don't deserve to be there. I'm not good enough. I mean, what right have I got to call myself a Christian? But if I've got its significance, I come to be reminded, not of a fact I already knew that Jesus died on the cross, but of a fact applied. And it'll answer all those questions in my mind without looking at me. See, every Lord's Supper should give me that morning after Passover feeling. That awe and fear as I realise the seriousness of sin. Brought last night about. The wonder and amazement as I try to take in how I can be spared its judgment. And there's something of the gratitude and the confidence as I grasp that Christ's death and blood mean I am passed over and saved. Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Come hesitant, by all means. But you've not learnt the lesson of the ritual if you don't go confident. If you go hesitant, you've missed the whole point. A friend of mine was telling me about an old member of his congregation and a conversation that he had with him. This guy had been going to church for 60 years, and one day they were just talking about his soul, and he said this. He said, I keep hoping that my good deeds will pay for my bad deeds, but they don't really put them right. It's not really fair, is it? And my friend said to him, don't you realize at communion, we remember that Christ died for bad deeds. You can't pay for them. Your good deeds certainly can't pay for them. But at communion, we remember Christ paid for them. And we accept his forgiveness. We celebrate it. Oh, said the old man, I'd never realized that. Makes you weep in some ways, doesn't it? 60 years in church. And he'd never realized that. Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. It's all been done. Of course, I know you have realized that. And I'm not teaching you anything new. My only excuse for teaching it tonight is just to say to you, do remember this morning. Remember Galatians. Remember, it's a truth we know, but not a truth we find easy to remember. Remember, it's a truth we know, but it's a truth we find very easy to start with and then head off in another direction. The other week I was talking with a minister of a very well-known evangelical church in this country. It was not St. Helens, and it was not Christ Church Forward. But this is what he said about his congregation. He said, they know the gospel. Of course they do. But day by day, they measure their relationship with God in terms of their performance. And not Jesus's. Of how well they think they've been, of whether they've read their Bibles, of whether they've prayed, of whether they've sinned terribly or not. That's how they measure their relationship with God, not with what Jesus has done on the cross. And he went on to say, it makes them either Pharisees or miserable worms. It doesn't matter what the church was, because actually I don't think it's a million miles away from any of us, is it? And it's because it's terribly easy for me to either become a Pharisee or a miserable worm. That is not enough that there was once the big fight. And even that once the big punch was landed. I keep on needing the big reminder. Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed.